You are tuned to CICK News on 93.9 FM in Smithers. CICK News is your news source for regional and provincial news Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m., 2 p.m., and 4 p.m. It's hosted by Dan Messick and myself, Pamela Hassan. Find and follow CICK News online at smithersradio.com and frequencynews.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. CICK News is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada.
Today on CICK News, opposition MLA for Skeena, Claire Ratté, is on the program today to talk about her ongoing advocacy to pressure the provincial government on policies pertaining to safe supply drugs in BC. Recently, the government of BC decided to end their safe supply practice in dealing with the toxic drug crisis in this province after years of trying to find a way out of the crippling drug overdoses in BC and the mounting deaths. The government announced it would end take-home safe supply after leaked internal health ministry slides revealed a significant portion of prescribed opioids in the province were being diverted and trafficked across BC. As of January 1st, the government of BC has changed that policy, and now anyone who is receiving prescribed opioids will have to take those opioids under supervision, something Ratté and other health professionals have been saying is long overdue. Here is my conversation with MLA Claire Ratté.
I'm Claire Ratté. I'm the MLA for Skeena. I'm also the official opposition critic for mental health, addiction, and housing supports, and I'm in Kitimat.
Great, Claire. Thanks so much for being with us here on CICK News again. As I had mentioned earlier, and here we are into 2026, the provincial government put out a statement retracting the safe supply position that they've had, something that you've been criticizing and bringing up in the legislature for some time now. So maybe tell me a little bit about what your reaction to the retraction of the provincial government on the safe supply.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, you know, safe supply program, or they like to call it prescribed alternatives now, because I think the name was quite misleading, because obviously I think most of us know that drugs aren't safe. But the purpose of it was supposed to be a harm reduction measure, a stopgap to help keep people alive long enough that we could get them into treatment so that they weren't overdosing on street supply. And the issue that I take with this program is I quite simply do not think it's effective. I don't think it works. So for a long time now, we've been calling government out on issues of diversion. They refused to acknowledge them until there were leaked reports that showed that diversion was actually quite widespread. And I do a lot of outreach work, especially in the Vancouver and Victoria area. And when I'm out speaking to people that are street entrenched, that are struggling with substance use disorders and mental health concerns and things like that, you know, many of them have told me straight to my face, knowing who I am and my position, that this program was something that they utilized to be able to get free drugs on the street, right? There are a lot of different ways to divert those medications. It's not difficult. And then when you also add in the fact that they've expanded the program to include things like fentanyl patches and Dilaudid and things that people are using, and, you know, this is going far beyond the scope of an opioid agonist therapy. And an opioid agonist therapy does have a role to play in helping people with substance use disorders. I think there needs to be stronger guidelines around it. I don't think anybody should be on methadone, for example, for 20 plus years. I think these should be short-term measures. But this program expanded far beyond that. And so the other issue that I had with it was that we weren't actually tracking it in statistics of overdose deaths. We have no way of knowing if anybody ever overdosed on street supply because they refuse, or sorry, on prescribed alternatives, I mean, because they have refused to use any kind of a chemical marker or a physical marker to be able to differentiate the two sources. So that right there told me that there is data that they don't want the public to recognize. Now, this latest change was actually, it was announced back in February of this past year, pardon. So February of 2025, the health minister announced that they were switching the program to supervised consumption. And the purpose of this was to try and cut down on diversion, obviously. If somebody's going to be utilizing the program, they want to be doing it in front of the prescribing pharmacist or doctor, taking the medications so that there's no chance of them being diverted. And while I recognize that this is a step in the right direction in the sense that obviously I want to see diversion stopped, I think that the wiser call here would have actually been to have stopped the program and to focus on the things that actually work, like an opioid agonist therapy. You know, I've got no problem with those as long as they're being used correctly. They have done a lot of good for a lot of people. But there's a lot of unintended consequences that have come from this shift towards supervised consumption, including a lot of people that legitimately need to take opioid-based medications for pain management, now being told that they have to take them under supervision. That was not ever supposed to be the intended purpose of this program. This is not the intended clientele. And I myself, through my office, have had to advocate for a number of people for exemptions from this program that have never struggled with any kind of form of addiction. That is not why they take these medications, and yet they're being lumped in to this same category. So it's not well thought out. There's not been nearly enough guidance put out by the ministry. You know, prescribers and physicians, they are quite concerned and unclear on how to navigate this now. So that's one whole section of it. But the biggest issue that I have with the Safe Supply Program is, so in February 2025, the minister announced that they were switching to supervised consumption. And in May of that same year, so just a few months later, the premier told us that there was only 1,918 people still accessing the program. Now, bear in mind, that goes from 2023, when this program was at its peak. There were 5,200 people that were accessing this program at its peak. The next month following that, in April of 2023, there were 240 fatal overdoses in the province. Now, fast forward to May 2025. Now we know we're moving towards supervised consumption. Suddenly we go from 5,200 people to only 1,918. So that right there tells you very clearly that once that switch was made, a vast majority of the people accessing this program were using it for the purposes of diversion. Now, beyond that, we go from 5,200 people and 240 fatal overdoses. Then we go to 1,918 people using this program. And the following month, June of 2025, we had 149 fatal overdoses in this province. So that's almost 100 fewer in that month. Now, I would think that if this program was effective and if it worked, you know, the evidence would tell us that when fewer people were accessing the program because they were concerned that there were barriers and all this kind of stuff, shouldn't our fatal overdoses have skyrocketed? Shouldn't there have been more? But there weren't. There were far fewer. And in fact, since these changes have been made to this program, amongst others, you know, rolling back things like decrim and stuff like that, and the pressure that we've kept on this government to try and roll back some of these policies, we're actually on track to have 2025 be our lowest year for fatal overdoses in this province since 2020, when they first started this program.
You know, Claire, looking into to some of the background, especially on the prevalence of prescription opioids, you know, 10, 15 years ago, the regime and the guidance around that was completely different. You know, it was to deal with someone's pain, always believe that they have, you know, the said level of pain, and to prescribe them opioids. And it seems that if needed, and it seems that you know, regime change has now led to this point of where we're just flooded, you know, with opioids. And, you know, speaking with nurses in previous years, you know, talking about how they suspected people were coming in and taking their prescription drugs for diversion purposes. Yes. But, you know, there was no recourse. I know you met recently with the minister, and I'm curious what you had to say to her about this and what the reaction was. As you mentioned, there are some changes now going into 2026. But what was the reaction, and what was your message to the minister about these issues?
I mean, as far as these issues are concerned, her and I have had a number of meetings on this topic, and we've spoken back and forth quite a bit. And I actually get along with Minister Osborne very well. I think that she's a very hardworking representative, and I think she wants to do the right thing. Now, obviously, we have different ideas about how to achieve that, but I think that she is far more reasonable and far less ideological than some of her predecessors. And we've managed to, you know, work through a few of these issues and have good conversations and kind of find some middle ground. And so I'm definitely hopeful, looking at the statistics right now, looking at the fact that our numbers are beginning to go down, knowing that this is a government that is finally listening to reason and starting to look at some of the rules around, you know, SROs and any of the, you know, social housing aspects and putting in some guardrails and encouraging treatment options and things like that. They're starting to get on the right track here. So I'm heartened to see that. It's going to be a very long road. This is absolutely a crisis of their own making. When you look at all of the failed policy changes over the last nearly decade now that they've been in power. And I mean, the premier himself has said that, you know, decrim was a failed experiment. He said, his words, not mine, that it had really unhappy consequences. And at the end of the day, I think that we've kind of played the tape through on trying out all these different ideological, you know, policy shifts, things like them funding the Drug Users Liberation Front with taxpayer money and all of these things and where it's ended up. So I'm hopeful that moving into this next year, they're going to see that some of the shifts towards the right direction have made some significant changes. I think that the work that Dr. Daniel Vigo is doing has been mostly excellent so far, based on what I've seen. And I let the minister know that. He's their chief scientific advisor and has been helping them kind of get on track with both voluntary and involuntary treatment options and trying to push forward on that. But the fact of the matter is, and the thing that I have definitely said to the minister a number of times and made very clear, is that based on this government's own documents showing how many treatment beds they have throughout this province, we only have 806 publicly funded treatment beds in this province. We know that that is not even going to make a small dent in this problem. And the fact that they are investing so much into involuntary treatment right now, well, we don't even have voluntary treatment for people. I mean, there's months-long wait lists. And it's just frustrating for me because, again, I think this is a problem of their own design. They have no choice now but to look into involuntary treatment. But how nice would it have been if we could have just focused on voluntary treatment, if we could have just made sure that when people were ready and they wanted to access these programs, they could, rather than waiting for them to end up with such a severe brain injury that they need to be taken into involuntary treatment. You know, but hindsight's 2020, and I'm not in government, so I can't control those things, but I'm certainly hopeful that the minister is starting to get on the right track here.
Claire, I just wanted to ask you, you know, a follow-up on some of this and localize it a bit. You know, we've obviously seen a bit of an acute issue with mental health and addictions here in the Northwest region, in your riding, also here in the area around Smithers. Recently, we saw a new group that was conceived about a year ago, BV Harm Reduction, Bulkley Valley Harm Reduction, apply for an application for an emergency temporary warming shelter that got approved. They got some money, and it's currently operating here in Smithers. There was a lot of noise made when it first came to the surface because it seemed like it was a done deal, but it's also a low barrier shelter, meaning that, you know, drug use and whatnot is allowed. And it seemed that the neighbors, especially, and some people in the community, although that they supported the warming shelter, of course, to get people out of the cold, the allowance of drug use was a big non-starter, and also just the transparency in which this process happened. You know, what's your sense and again, your messaging to the government, to the ministry and BC Housing, because this is where the application went, in terms of the transparency and being more communicative with not only the communities where these shelters are being set up and these programs are being set up, but also with the adjacent properties, the neighbors of these properties, which from our reporting, you know, seems to be that they knew very little about this and that the transparency of the process was pretty low.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I'll start off by saying that when it comes to homelessness, when it comes to tackling this issue that we're facing in Northwest BC, this is of utmost importance right now. We really do need to put a significant amount of focus on fixing this problem. And obviously, I don't represent the Smithers area, so I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but I can tell you that per 10,000 population in Victoria, there are 18 people that are homeless per 10,000. In Vancouver, there are 37 per 10,000. In Kitimat, there are 83 per 10,000. And in Terrace, there are 109 per 10,000. So when you look at it like that, you know, obviously overall numbers, we don't have as many people that are unhoused. But certainly when you look at it per capita, it's quite alarming to see how many people are unhoused in our region. And you add into that, you know, our weather and all of those kinds of things and a lack of services. This is a really serious issue that's not going to go away on its own. Now, the barriers for people, the reasons that lead to them being homeless are going to be different in each community. That's what I found. There are different factors in that. But the fact of the matter is, this is an issue that has to be approached and dealt with. And, you know, I certainly am supportive of shelters and the concept of getting people out, you know, inside out of the cold and making sure that they have access to basic amenities. I think that, you know, any human being deserves that. The issue, I think, is more so around, and I think this is the majority of British Columbians have the issue more so around the use of drugs and a lack of rules when these facilities are being operated, particularly in areas that are residential or commercial, because they can obviously disrupt the neighbors. And so, you know, the big problem I see here is that this ministry has not laid out clear guidelines. It is been very much so, you know, this set of rules for one group, this set of rules for a different one. There's nothing consistent. We heard back in, I believe it was April of 2025, the minister had announced that they were going to be making some significant changes to their social housing policies. And unfortunately, we have as of yet not heard any of those. And that was in a response to all of the issues that we've seen in SROs in the Vancouver area, particularly, but in general in urban areas. But also in some of our more northern, rural, and remote communities, there have been these issues around shelters and social housing, and a lack of enforcement, a lack of rules, and the biggest one being that under residential tenancy branch rules, the inability to kick out bad actors, to kick out tenants that aren't following rules, that are making it difficult for everyone else. And so as of yet, there haven't been any of those changes. I haven't personally dug too deep into how they go about notifying the neighbors in the area. One thing I will say is that I really strongly disagree with the, there's kind of a current rhetoric around the support for supportive housing, that if you don't support supportive housing in all of its forms and in any way that it may, you know, end up happening, that you are not a compassionate person. Compassion is weaponized against you. So if you support supportive housing, but you don't support the concept of supportive housing with, you know, this super low barrier, anybody can do drugs and they can do whatever they want, then all of a sudden you're not a compassionate person. And I just strongly disagree with that. As somebody that is a recovered addict myself, as somebody that is homeless, I understand, you know, wanting to be compassionate and empathetic for people in that position. And I am, because I was that person. But the fact of the matter is that we can't be just catering to a small group of people because they want shelter, but they also want to be able to do drugs while they're in this shelter at the expense of everyone else around them. So I think there do need to be rules. I think that we do owe that to the neighbors in the area, whether they are residential or commercial tenants. It doesn't really matter. I think that everybody deserves to be able to feel comfortable and safe walking down the street of their neighborhood. And, you know, unfortunately, the fact of the matter is that supportive housing models that, you know, not only allow, but in many cases encourage open drug use, lead to a lot of problems for people, and people don't feel safe, including many of the tenants. You know, you've also got to remember, it's not just people that use drugs, that have substance use disorders, that need access to shelter. You have a lot of elderly people now that need access to shelter. You have young moms with young children that need access to shelter. So why are we putting the rights of a few people that want to be able to use drugs ahead of the fact that we've got other people that also need access to shelter? You know, I think that, you know, if you need shelter badly enough, you can not do drugs while you're staying in the shelter, and you can go and do them somewhere else later. That's really not asking that much of people to make sure that as a society, we aren't encouraging and incentivizing poor behavior. You know, that being coupled with the fact that obviously we do not have enough access to treatment, we do not have enough access to mental health supports. I'm not blaming or stigmatizing somebody that struggles with a substance use disorder. Again, I was one of them. And you need to provide people with pathways out of that. You need to provide them with opportunities. You need to provide them with, you know, the supports that they need to get out of that place. But you also can't take away all personal responsibility and say, yeah, just do it wherever you want, that's fine. That doesn't encourage anyone to improve their life, right? So you know, it's a very difficult situation, it's a difficult topic, but I think there is a way to make both things work, and to ensure that we are supporting that vulnerable population that needs the help.
You've been listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or check us out on the web at smithersradio.com. CICK News has been made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to my colleague Pam Hassan and all of our roving journalists, I'm Daniel Messick. Thanks for listening.